Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. You know, we've had a few weeks here where we spent a lot of time talking about the troubles plaguing Donald Trump and his campaign. This week, we're going to talk about thorns in the side of Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. We'll also talk about the uncomfortable exchange between Megyn Kelly and Newt Gingrich on Fox News' The Kelly Files. And we've got a couple of non-political issues that I want to talk to our panelists about, including the ProPublica investigation into Facebook advertising and the end of Twitter's Vine platform. But let's start with CNN cutting ties with interim Democratic National Committee Chair Donna Brazile after a hacked email released by WikiLeaks showed that Brazile gave Clinton and her campaign a question that would be posed to her before the Democratic debate in Flint, Michigan, as well as a possible question prior to a CNN town hall, both of those happening in March of last spring. A CNN spokesperson said the network accepted Brazile's resignation as a CNN contributor on Monday. It had been, her role there had been under suspension since July when she became the interim DNC chair. We've talked a lot about CNN and its ickiness with Corey Lewandowski. This doesn't bode well for the cable network either.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, here's the issue with that. I think they were looking for a way out because she had already taken over as the DNC chair. So the whole WikiLeaks thing gave them an opportunity to cut ties with her. And I think that CNN is beginning to really think about and consider whether or not these ties to political operatives and bringing them in as pundits and giving them platforms in which to speak, whether or not that really is going to be something that CNN wants to hang its brand on. And I'm getting a sense that many of the news side people, the really hardcore news side people, are winning out on this issue.
I hope you're right about that. I'm not convinced yet that you're right about that. I mean, it's obvious CNN is trying to manage the damage that's come from this. And, you know, first of all, we should probably say, I mean, what Donna Brazile did was wrong. And it's this sort of defense about the WikiLeaks emails that, oh, well, it was hacked by the Russians, isn't a good enough defense anymore. This behavior is wrong. And basically, she's acknowledged doing it. But CNN's behavior is what bothers me. She should not have been in a position to do this in the first place. I mean, they only suspended their relationship with her after she took over as acting chair of the DNC.
Result of some hacked emails.
She was vice chair of the DNC the entire time that she was on the air as a commentator. And this gets to the bigger question that we're talking about. But CNN didn't announce that they were parting ways with her permanently until 2 weeks after the first WikiLeaks email that came out and said that she had had access to the questions. And it only came the day that there was another leak that said, oh, here's an email that says, I get access to these questions from time to time. So CNN knew about this before they acted, 2 weeks before they acted, and I think they only did so because they knew it was going to be a stain on them when the story came out.
Well, to me, it's one of those things about, okay, you bring people like Donna Brazile in and Lewandowski in because they have a connection to these campaigns that allows you to have access. But with that connection and with that access comes some baggage. And this is one of those things where if they get a piece of information that they feel is going to help the candidate that they support and have supported for a long time, they're going to give that information because that's what they do. That's who they are.
That's the definition of supporting the candidate.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, CNN is guilty of doing this on both sides of the political spectrum. I mean, they have an analyst on the Democratic side who actually vetted a commentary piece with the DNC before it showed up on CNN's website. So this whole notion of hiring these insiders who are still on the payroll of the parties or the candidates is a bad idea. And it's actually sort of the natural extension of what's been going on for years. I mean, think about George Stephanopoulos being hired straight off of the Clinton White House to work at ABC News as a journalist. Or even think all the way back to Diane Sawyer, who worked for the Nixon administration and then gets hired as a journalist. We ought to be at least transparent about that, but I think maybe we ought to be more careful about doing it at all.
Well, I mean, you would think that they would be careful, but I mean, here's the situation. You've got Fox, who's been doing it since its inception. Mm-hmm. Okay, and MSNBC the same way. And you had now you have CNN trying to make some sort of a mark as being sort of middle of the road, but still having the ability to bring in a Donna Brazile, bring in a Lewandowski to say we're playing both sides of the fence because we have operatives who are in both camps.
And CNN is kind of in this awkward position too, because in order to remain competitive, they kind of had to join in on the screaming talking head phenomenon. Look what happened to Al Jazeera America when it didn't.
Right, right.
But they're also risking damaging the relationship among their own journalists with the news organization. I mean, Jake Tapper, who is probably one of the best television journalists, political journalists anywhere, was incensed and said so on radio when this first came out about Donna Brazile. And if they keep trying to have these paid players from the parties on, they risk alienating the journalists who are doing the real work at that.
And
moment.
And to a certain extent, they also hurt their brand. Mm-hmm. Because CNN is the place where people go to get that kind of straightforward news and information, even during highly charged political campaigns like what we have now. People are still doing that. And if you decide you're going to go down this road, you can do some serious damage to your brand.
Okay, well, another story that kind of came up and was that thorn in the side for Hillary Clinton. Another story about emails and Hillary Clinton that led to a bad week. Friday, a letter from FBI Director James Comey to lawmakers about emails relating to the closed investigation into her use of a private email server and things that were found on Anthony Weiner's computer. Weiner, of course, is the estranged husband of longtime Clinton aide Huma Abedin. I've got no better word for this than to call the whole thing a mess. And when the likes of Glenn Beck call it a mess, it's got to be. Like, when he starts defending Hillary Clinton, that's maybe saying there isn't so much smoke here with this fire.
Also, this story is just like the perfect storm. I mean, it brings back the emails. It brings back the FBI. It feeds into this journalist's desire to have the race at the end be really, really tight. And it has sex.
Yeah.
I mean, it has Anthony Weiner in it.
Yeah, but think about this. It even brings back J. Edgar Hoover's name into the conversation and all the dirty deals and dirty tricks that he did when he was FBI director. The problem here is that Comey decided to release this information or to send this letter to Congress with 11 days into the election and open up a door that the Clinton campaign thought had been closed, even though Trump has been talking about this and using the whole phrase of lock her up because there is something there, and now there appears to be something there. And with 11 days to go, you already had voting started in several places, you know, and you have Republicans worried about it, Democrats, Republicans worried about it because they're afraid that it's somewhere down the road. It could happen to them in some case if you have an FBI director that decides to do that. And when the Democrats are concerned because they're thinking, wait a minute, there's some undecided voters out there who may decide to switch back when the race was clearly headed in our direction.
And I guess I'll let the voters decide whether they think this is an important enough story and should have been covered or whether it should affect their vote or whatever. What interests me is the media's reaction to the whole thing. And it kind of brings me back to this criticism I've been, you know, that can the news media walk and chew gum at the same
time?
That's
my new favorite line.
Right. Yeah. I mean, here is the single narrative coming out of this is Comey messed up. He went against the protocol of the Justice Department. He's putting his thumb on the scale of justice. You know, he's being inconsistent. I mean, those are all fair stories to report on if other people are making those criticisms. But there's also a story out there about, and some news organizations have covered it, not the ones on TV, about, you know, the competing pressures that Comey is under and whether or not Loretta Lynch's meeting with Bill Clinton on the tarmac in Arizona this summer might have forced his hand in one direction or another. Or for that matter, you've got, you know, Fox News focusing on, you know, some of these other angles that I think the other news media ought to be thinking about, too. There's more than one story.
Yeah, there is more than one story. And the other narrative being played out that the media has finally touched on is the fact that you've had weeks and weeks and weeks of people saying, why hasn't the FBI talked about the connection of the Russians to the hacked emails of the DNC and others? And where's that investigation? And why has that not been talked about by Comey or anyone else at the FBI? And basically they're saying, well, we don't want to influence the election. Well,
you already did.
You just did in the case of Hillary Clinton's email. So, I mean, that story is starting to come out as well. So it's these inconsistencies that I think the media really needs to hone in on.
I do think there's a common mistake that journalists make because of deadline pressure. Mm-hmm. And that was the reporting early on from all news organizations that, quote, the FBI had reopened the investigation.
Right, right.
That came from Jason Chaffetz, the chairman of a House committee investigating the emails. He used that word. Comey didn't use that word. And yet the media jumped on that to say the FBI has reopened the investigation. Should have backed off on that language.
Okay, so here's a question that you probably would say you already know the answer to. Where is Trump's headquarters? Chances are you would rightly say inside Trump Tower. But he's got an outpost across the street from a Lazy Boy furniture gallery in San Antonio, Texas, where more than 100 people are working day and night on online strategy, including an effort to keep people away from the polls on Tuesday.
I think that they've developed a strategy which is sort of dubious from a sort of scientific perspective, but they have no idea how fraught the term suppression is. They think that what they're doing is basically going to the most unreliable parts of the Democratic coalition, these groups that were you have a lot of voters who are not regular voters, and where polls show not a lot of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton over the end of the year, over the course of the year, and they think that if they give them negative information about Hillary Clinton, it'll keep them home. That's a little different than I think what the term suppression means legally, but the fact that they threw that around as freely as they did with us, I think, is a sign that they don't come out of a political milieu where they realize that that's
a taboo word. You don't need to be a political expert. You just need to have some sense of morality and PR to not say that to a journalist.
So that was Sasha Eisenberg, one of the authors of a long read from Bloomberg Businessweek, and it took a look inside Tribune's online campaign headquarters. It's a fascinating look behind the curtain in terms of social media and online strategy. What about it specifically stood out to you?
Well, the thing that stood out to me in looking at this is I think he's got a point there. When you talk about voter suppression, when most people think about voter suppression, they're thinking that there's somebody at the polling place that's going to keep you from voting, or they're going to somehow keep you from getting a voter registration card. Mm-hmm. That's what most people are thinking about. Here, what they're talking about is sending out information that causes you to say, well, my vote's not going to matter, or, I'm so upset with both of these candidates that I'm just not going to vote. And that, I think, is where you sort of find that subtle, dubious sort of issue mm-hmm. that he was addressing there.
I thought it was a really fascinating inside story. But when it comes to suppression, it was stupid for the guy to be quoted as saying that. But if you think that candidates and campaigns on all sides don't try to suppress their opponent's vote while also trying to engage in getting their vote to turn out, you're naive. That happens on both sides. What if you just don't focus on the message itself, right, but on the tactic? What I found really interesting about this was that everybody's accused Donald Trump for months now of having this liability because he's going on social media, on Twitter all the time, and saying things that he should think twice about. But this also shows that they've got a sophisticated social media strategy with a database behind it. And this is going to help Trump whether he wins or he loses.
And it's not but they're not sending out the traditional message mm-hmm. that you send out through social media, and basically what Obama did and what Clinton did.
And that's one of the things that was most fascinating to me about this article, how it went into some of the details about how Trump and his campaign staff negotiated with the GOP in terms of who owns the accounts and who owns this kind of virtual property, so that regardless of what happens at the end of next Tuesday night, Donald Trump and his entity owns all of those social media accounts, owns all of the access to those followers on Facebook, on Twitter, whatever that is, not the GOP, which is not how things have been done previously.
But this goes back to what many people have been saying for basically since the RNC mm-hmm. convention when he was nominated, is he's trying to build a media empire. And he owns this and controls this, not the GOP. So to me, I'm not surprised by any of this. This is who he is. Donald Trump is a businessman, and this is all about building his brand and building his empire.
And whether or not you think he's going to launch some TV enterprise from all of this, what it does show is that what the Republicans say they care about going forward, which is being a more inclusive party, is not what Trump cares about in this particular social media operation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, remember about 10 days ago when it seemed like the whole internet went down? Sites like Twitter and Amazon and Airbnb were all unreachable for a few hours after a denial of services attack made reaching the sites impossible. Well, denial of services attacks are real, and we've seen that here in Colombia. It happens when a site is taken over. It's happened in the past year or so to KOMU and to the Colombia Daily Tribune. And now, as we prepare for next Tuesday's election coverage, there's potentially some reason for concern. Mike, what exactly are these attacks?
Well, so a distributed denial of service attack basically means that hackers infect computers, and in this instance, also mobile phones and even baby monitors that are connected to the internet, and they use them to flood a site. It could be a news media site, or it could be these larger companies that are actually the tollways or the gateways for people to access the internet. And the flood of requests basically shuts down the servers because they can't handle the traffic. And what's really new about this, one, they've targeted these bigger entities, and two, they're taking advantage of what we call the Internet of Things, all these devices in our homes now that are connected wirelessly, and the security setups on those devices are not nearly as good as the ones on our laptop and desktop computers.
Yeah, the big thing that they're going after is the modems, the wireless modems that you have in your home that has this sort of security number when you get it and open up the box and you're supposed to put it on everything. Well, the problem is that many of those things are available, and they know what they are, and they can use those numbers to basically infect everything that you have connected to that wireless modem.
So is the news media, our large news organizations, susceptible in the next week? Is this something we need to be worrying about? We're not going to be able to get to the New York Times next Tuesday night?
I mean, they've been targeted in the past directly by hackers, and they've learned, these larger media organizations have hired security specialists, and they have a pretty good handle on how to react to this. But when the attacks go against the bigger companies that provide the gateways, I mean, you saw it last week. I mean, half the United States was having trouble getting online to anything, including news media.
Because they got it to the gateway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I promise, we're almost done talking about politics and election stuff. But before we move on, I want to take a minute or two to discuss the contentious interview last week on Fox News. Megyn Kelly talking to former House Speaker and Trump surrogate, Newt Gingrich. It was about 9 minutes, and at one point, they argued about polling data and what was legitimate and what wasn't. I wish I could play you the whole thing, but time won't allow. So let's skip to the part where Gingrich tells Kelly that she's obsessed with sex. Here's how it happened.
What I said is, if Trump is a sexual predator, then it's a big story. And what we saw on that tape was Trump himself saying that he likes to grab women by the genitals and kiss them against their will. That's what we saw. Then we saw 10 women come forward after he denied actually doing it at a debate to say that was untrue. He did it to me. He did it to me. We saw reporters. We saw people who had worked with him, people from Apprentice and so on and so forth. He denies it all, which is his right. We don't know what the truth is. My point to you is, as a media story, we don't get to say the 10 women are lying. We have to cover that story, sir.
Sure. Okay, so it's worth 23 minutes of the three networks to cover that story. And Hillary Clinton in a secret speech in Brazil to a bank that pays her $225,000, saying her dream is an open border where 600 million people could come to America. That's not worth covering.
That is worth covering.
When you
want
to go back through the tapes of your show recently, you are fascinated with sex and you don't care about public policy.
Me?
So that's
really
what I get out of watching you tonight.
The expressions on her face say it all. Margaret Sullivan had an interesting take on this in the Washington Post, and I loved it. The headline on her story, on her column, called it a killer moment that was a return to badassery.
Well, you know, I think it was one of those instances where you had a surrogate who had probably been talking about this over and over and over again and basically said, you know, I'm done. I just, you know, I can't talk about this, anymore. And he lost it. He lost it at Megyn Kelly, and he basically said something that he probably, as soon as it came out of his mouth, was ready to yank back.
You know, here's the thing. Newt Gingrich was having a classic sort of conversation with a journalist asking tough questions. He had points to make, and they were valid points from his perspective, but it very quickly devolved into talking over a woman journalist and then mansplaining. Let me tell you how it is, little lady, basically. Yeah. And that's where he lost it. And the problem is, this is not an isolated incident. Not even with regard to Megyn Kelly, let alone women journalists in general.
But to me, it's part of the issue where, you know, know, it's not just Newt Gingrich. Mm-hmm. I mean, you also have Rudy Giuliani out there doing the same thing. And then you have Trump at the top doing the same thing. So it's sort of a pattern. I mean, it's not only, you know, Trump goes out and these people latch on him because he's saying what they've been wanting to say, and they go out and they do it. I mean, it's what this campaign has devolved into.
I mean, the thing is, Megyn Kelly is, whether she meant to do it or not, has become basically the focus for women journalists basically standing up against the sexism mm-hmm. that's going on. I mean, the question she asked in the debate, you know, the Republican debate and the response that came to that, this whole thing with Newt Gingrich, and for that matter, behind the scenes when she testified against Roger Ailes in that internal investigation that got him kicked out at Fox News, she's been the person who's sort of represented women journalists who are trying to fight back against
and sexism. She makes very valid points. She says, look, we're basically covering this story because it's out there, and we're not saying that one story is invalid over another. We're basically covering the story.
It also, you know, frankly, I mean, there's people criticizing her now. What's the comeback? Well, she's just self-promoting because she's got a book coming out, or she's got her contract is up for renewal. And both of those things can happen at the same time. We can walk and chew gum people, right? But, you know, if you ask, I asked today in class, you know, we had a class of, everyone in the class was female, right? And I asked them for their own examples of this, and there were lots. And how they deal every single day with a source or with their own colleagues is just, it's fascinating and it's kind of depressing, too.
Yes, it is. If you ask me, this one falls into the category of not a moment too soon. You know those ads that show up at the bottom of news websites with recommendations for other stories that the internet thinks you might be interested in from around the web? You know, the kind that they tease that child stars who have died quietly, or how to get rid of toenail fungus. Well, The New Yorker and Slate have dropped those ads. Why the change of heart?
I'm just going to say I'm glad they dropped it.
This is like the greatest thing I ever saw.
I think part of it is because that was annoying people. I mean, the ads were supposed to be there to help, mm-hmm. and that's not, or to drive in traffic or bring in traffic. And I think it was annoying people to the point where they just figured out, no, this isn't going to work. They're not seeing the numbers that they thought they were going to get.
I mean, it's really complicated because these companies that provide what you call programmatic right. or remnant advertising, mm-hmm. I mean, they are filling a need because advertising dollars are not pouring in to news organizations. It's really lowest common denominator money. It's not very good money, but it's money. The problem is this stuff does kind of look like journalism at the beginning. When you click on the link, sometimes you're going to some pretty skeevy places, and it's damaging the brand of these news.
Well, it's sort of like the old advertorials they used to have in newspapers where, you know, you think that you're actually reading an article when, in fact, you were reading a piece of advertising. And this is just the same thing. And I think it was coming back to bite some of the people that were using it.
I know that when I was working at the Chicago Tribune and we first started using these, they were kind of sold to us in the newsroom as this is a great opportunity for alternative revenue. It's another way to bring in some advertising revenue that we don't have to do anything to get. What is this saying, too, about failed alternative revenue streams and how they're actually creating a pretty bad user experience?
The problem is the publisher is giving up control.
Control, yeah.
And they need the control. They need to offer better products, better advertising opportunities that can generate the kind of money they need. I mean, they can't just say, oh, throw out this money if we can't find some new money. But it's about control.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you about an interesting investigation from ProPublica, which looked at the way that businesses and individuals, too, I guess, can advertise on Facebook. Its targeting tool makes it possible to select who sees the ads, and among the categories it offers is a breakdown of Facebook users by race. Now, some in advertising might call this segmenting, and yeah, it's really helpful when you're trying to reach women with children who are in the age bracket of 25, say, to 34, but when you figure that this is an option that's available for job postings or for housing, it's actually discrimination.
It is actually discrimination. I mean, I would urge our listeners and viewers to go and read this article on our links blog mm-hmm. because the beginning of it is clear and blatant violation of the Fair Housing Act and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. To actually be able to discriminate in that way by clicking on no, I don't want African Americans, no, I don't want Hispanics in your ad that you're putting on Facebook for selling your house mm-hmm. is a clear violation. And the fact that they did it and didn't have a lawyer look over to see that, it just boggles my mind.
So Facebook says that anybody who does that in the category of housing or in employment or in credit, that if they do target or choose not to have certain races show up, that that's a violation of the Facebook terms of service and that they could be prevented from
advertising. But here's the problem I have with that. It's Facebook's responsibility to make sure that doesn't happen. Not they set it up that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
No,
you don't
please.
Get a pass for that. You don't get a pass for that.
Although they want to get a pass for it because they still argue to this day, I mean, they, meaning Facebook mm-hmm. or Google for that matter, that uses the same kind of algorithms for advertising, they say, you know, we're not publishers. We're this utility, this social utility.
We can't police all these people. But you can't have it both ways. You can't say I'm not a publisher and then you put this out there and you're doing these violations and then it's supposed to be okay.
I'm not agreeing with them. I'm just saying that's the line they use. They also made this sort of lame excuse that they say, we didn't say we were letting people, you know, block ads based on race or ethnicity, but on ethnic affinity, meaning I could be white, but I have an affinity to all things African-American, and therefore you're going to block me too. That's also kind of a bogus argument, but it does get to how sophisticated Facebook and Google can be in terms of letting you target. And I have to say this about publishers. I mean, they quoted an example from the New York Times saying, we have policies and we police these policies and these kinds of ads don't show up. But the New York Times and every other traditional publisher in America does not have the tools that Facebook and Google has. And they would love to have those tools. So again, they could be in control. And some of these things might happen if they were in control.
Is this the type of thing you see the Justice Department going after?
Oh, I think if they get enough complaints, yeah, they'll go after it. I mean, and if you have some members of Congress who are taking a look at this and saying, whoa, wait a minute, you know, then all of a sudden what you're going to see is there's going to be an investigation. Then there'll be a rollback by Facebook as they did when we were talking about this early on mm-hmm. about the problems they were having with the stories that they
trending topics,
the trending
situations,
topics and that sort of thing. So I could see it happening
again.
Stuff.
Well, before we go today, the end of an era. Well, I don't know. Maybe 3 years is considered an era. Maybe not. Twitter is killing off Vine, the social media platform launched in 2013 that featured 6-second video loops. And as popular as it was in 2013, it hasn't seen much growth since then. Just couldn't compete with Snapchat and Instagram, could it?
Nope, could not. And, you know, I'm not sorry to see it go. The market is going to have its impact, and there are plenty of ways to get short videos online these days.
Does this tell us anything about the health of Twitter?
I mean, I think Twitter's going to have to regroup, and I think they will. I mean, there's still going to be an audience out there for it. But as we saw with Snapchat and all the others, I mean, you know, Facebook, it's gotten older and that sort of thing. This is going to go that same route.
Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Kyle Felling for handling the audio. Megan Sheets is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.